I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Here are some questions from the ACE test to determine adverse childhood experiences. And it's from a study done by the Centers for Disease Control and Kaiser Permanente, published something like 20 years ago. Prior to your 18th birthday, did a parent or other adult in the household often swear at you, insult you, put you down, or humiliate you, or act in a way that made you feel afraid you might be physically hurt? Yes or no? Did a parent or other adult in the household often push, grab, slap, or throw something at you, or ever hit you so hard you had marks or were injured? Yes or no? Did you often feel that no one in your family loved you or thought you were important or special, or your family didn't look out for each other, feel close to each other, or support each other? Our guest physician, Nadine Burke Harris, observed that many of her young patients in a low-income community in San Francisco where she works had what would be called failure to thrive, not meeting their developmental milestones and dealing with serious and chronic illnesses. She has made the ACE test an integral part of her practice, asking patients and their caregivers questions about family interactions and conditions in their household, realizing there is a link between childhood trauma and health and development, and that toxic stress is a disease with serious, even life-threatening symptoms and side effects. She's got a brand new book. It's called The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. She is founder and CEO of the Center for Youth Wellness in San Francisco, and she joins us on Radio Times. Dr. Burke Harris, nice to have you with us on the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Let's begin with Diego, which is how you begin your book. He was a young patient referred to you, basically changed your life and changed your work.
Yes, that's right. Diego was a patient who was referred to me for ADHD, or Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder. And when I examined him, what I found, he actually had a couple of things going on. In addition to behavior problems, he also had asthma, eczema, or skin inflammation, and he was teeny tiny. He was a 7-year-old boy, and yet his height was average for a 4-year-old.
Wow.
And when I did, you know, what is my job? When I did a history and a physical exam, and I asked mom when he started having problems in his behavior, that was when she told me that his behavior problems began after he experienced a sexual assault.
And this was a tenant that was living in their house, and obviously a traumatic experience for
yes.
a child. How did, though, Diego change your life, if I can put it that way?
For some time, I had been suspecting that there might be a connection between the stressful and traumatic events that my patients experience and their health. But Diego's presentation was so striking that it really got me looking at what was this connection between the trauma he experienced and actually all of the health problems. Mm-hmm. And as I dove into the research and the science about how early adversity affects the developing brains and bodies of children, that's when I came across the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, which is the research done by the CDC and Kaiser.
I mean, could we say that Diego, after this trauma of sexual abuse or assault, stopped growing? I mean, was that his body's response? Can we determine that?
Yeah, that is actually what happened in that situation, yes.
Because of just literally what happens to especially a young child, this is a 7-year-old, what happens to their body, the development, when faced with toxic stress?
Well, what we now understand about toxic stress is that toxic stress is actually the body's reaction to prolonged stressful or traumatic experiences. And actually what happens in the body is that we make more stress hormones, including adrenaline and cortisol. And these hormones have an effect on every part of a child's developing brain and body. So it affects the nervous system, the hormonal systems, the immune system, and even the way our DNA is read and transcribed.
Wow. I mean, that's a dramatic and almost complete effect that toxic stress can have on development.
That's exactly right. And in fact, what we see is that in children, listen, it's really common for us to recognize that when a child experiences something traumatic, they may have behavior problems.
Right.
But what the last two decades of research have now illuminated is that the effects of toxic stress and the symptoms can be poor sleep, poor growth, increased risk of infection, chronic headache or abdominal pain, even autoimmune disease when the immune system attacks itself.
We're talking about emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. I'm quoting from your book here, physical neglect, emotional neglect, substance abuse in the household, mental illness in the household, mother treated violently, divorce or separation, criminal behavior in household. That's a long list, and those are each one by themselves a serious problem for a child to have to deal with. I know there's a kind of a rating system, how many times someone would say yes or no to that ACE test. When do you become concerned?
Well, we're concerned any time that a patient is experiencing adverse childhood experiences. Because let's think about it. This is not like, you know, failing a test or losing a basketball game. These are threats that are so severe or pervasive that they literally get under our skin and change our biology. And so after seeing Diego and diving into the research, one of the big ways that this work changed my clinical practice was that we began screening all of our patients for adverse childhood experiences. Because one of the things, one of the major findings from the CDC research, when they looked at these factors in over 17,000 adults, was that two-thirds of them had experienced at least one adverse childhood experience.
Wow.
And about one in eight individuals had experienced four or more. And the CDC now collects this data nationally. And of the 32 states and the District of Columbia that collect this data, all of them report between half and two-thirds of the population with at least one ACE, and between 13 and 17% of the population with four or more adverse childhood experiences.
Well, I'm just trying to imagine being a child and having to check off four of these and what their life. I mean, in many ways, this is what the child's life is like. It's not, you know, losing the homework paper or losing the basketball game. It's, this is your life.
Yeah, it's coming home to situations that can be unpredictable and unstable at times. And oftentimes, you know, for a lot of my patients, when I talk about it, I don't even actually, interestingly, as awful as these things sound, oftentimes I don't even talk about trauma. I talk about drama.
Drama.
Right? Because many of these things are so endemic in some of our communities that they're just the way that things are. It's like, yeah, you know, I have a parent who's alcoholic, or, you know, sure, my dad got arrested. That's everyone in my neighborhood, their dad got arrested. You know what I mean? And so understanding how we can take things that are oftentimes really commonplace,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially if we're talking about two-thirds of the American population, right? And understand how, in many ways, it's almost like you know, secondhand smoke, right? It's incredibly common, but for many of us, we don't know that it's damaging to our biology.
I'm thinking of the fight or flight response, which you write about, and, mm-hmm. and clearly this was one of our ways as we evolved to respond to environmental stresses, whether it was that tiger, that lion, or whether we were stressed because there was not enough to eat. So that took us to where we are. What happens when that is overstressed?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that I want to mention is that our stress response, our fight or flight response, it evolved to save our lives, right? So we release these hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, and they help to do things like raise our blood pressure, raise our blood sugar, right? Increase our heart rate. And all of those things are really good if you're trying to run away from a bear in the woods.
Right.
But the problem is if you have those hormones doing that all the time, then all of these responses in our bodies become chronic, and they go from being adaptive or life-saving to being maladaptive or health damaging.
And literally paying with it, with our health, or maybe even our life, with a shortened lifespan.
That's exactly right. So what the CDC and Kaiser Permanente found in this groundbreaking research study was that individuals who had four or more adverse childhood experiences had double the risk for heart disease, double the risk for cancer, 2.5 times the risk for stroke. And for individuals with very high doses, with 7 or more adverse childhood experiences, their risk of heart disease was triple, their risk of cancer was triple, and their risk and the difference in their life expectancy was 20 years.
This is a study that was done, 20 years ago?
It was.
1998, if I have my numbers correct. Here we are in 2018, 20 years later.
Yeah.
So what happened to this study? Why did it not get more press play coverage?
Honestly, that is the question that I asked myself the first time I read this paper, because I read the study in 2008, and it had been published a decade before. And when I looked at it, I thought to myself, how is it possible that I never learned about this in medical school or residency? Because this is something that was affecting a huge number of my patients. And we're talking about the health risk. It's a major health risk. We're not talking about, a 10% increase in the risk of heart disease. We're talking about double your risk. And it was baffling to me that I didn't learn about this. And that's a big part of, how this has transformed my work and my career since coming across this information. And that's why I wrote the book, because I believe that knowledge is power.
Hmm.
When folks actually are able to recognize and understand, oh, wait a minute, because of what's happened to me in my life, I may actually have an overactive stress response. And the good news is, there's stuff that we can do about that, right?
We're almost up on a break here, but is that something when you say to your patients or your patients' caregivers, there might be something stressful causing some of these symptoms, does the light bulb go off?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that happens most commonly is, I say this to my teenagers, because oftentimes my teenagers have been told that they're messing up, right? My teenagers with an overactive stress response who have trouble with their impulse control and have difficulty regulating themselves, they've been told that they are troublemakers. And when I say, because of what has happened to you, you have an overactive stress response, they say, you mean I'm not crazy?
Mm. That is Nadine Burke Harris. She's a physician, and she's also an author now. Her brand new book is just out. It's called The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Dr. Burke Harris about her work with young patients in San Francisco, the impact of toxic stress, and her new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity, which helps explain the link between childhood trauma, toxic stress, and disease, even early death. And again, you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. I wonder, too, whether this study, that this ACE study that is so much a part of your practice now, whether that the fact that it hasn't gotten the kind of play that it probably deserved 20 years ago is we're still wrestling with this mind-body divide. Somehow the body is over here, the mind is over there, and we don't really connect the two.
I think it's fascinating to see the way that we in our society, we have medical care, and then we have mental health care. They're totally separate. Half the time, insurance doesn't pay for mental health.
Exactly.
And yet we make that distinction, but the body doesn't make that distinction, right? So when a person experiences something stressful or traumatic, what gets activated in the body is just one system, right? And we probably do a much better job in our society of recognizing the behavioral symptoms than we do in recognize the symptoms when they're not behavioral.
This is less a medical question and more maybe a political or sociological question, but do we also blame people for their behavior? I mean, we say, you're obese, you are in jail, you're a troublemaker, and it's your fault.
I think that's one of the biggest obstacles that this is facing, because when the study was first published, some of the big criticism that the original researchers, Dr. Vince Felitti and Dr. Robert Onda, faced was, isn't the reason that these folks have these worse health outcomes because, you know, they do it to themselves. Right. They drink, they smoke, they overeat, and they engage in high-risk behavior. And certainly, health-damaging behaviors, folks who have high levels of adverse childhood experiences are more likely to engage in health-damaging behaviors. And ask me, I'm going to come back to that in just a second.
Fair enough.
But even if you don't engage in any health-damaging behaviors, you're still at greater risk for all of these different health problems. And a big part of the reason for that is because of the long-term changes of an overactive stress response and the changes to our brain, immune system, and hormonal systems.
It also underscores just the amount of child abuse, neglect, whatever you want to call it, in this country, maybe other countries as well. But that's just a fact that I think we don't really deal with. And then that becomes generational. So you see patterns repeated.
That's exactly right. For kids who experienced, high amounts of ACEs, and if they have toxic stress and they have an overactive stress response, guess what? When they grow up to become parents, it may be more difficult for them to hold down a job, right? Or to engage in stable and healthy relationships. And when their child does something that's perfectly developmentally appropriate, for someone with an overactive stress response, right, we're more likely to get in trouble, and it's handed down from generation to generation.
You wanted to go back to something, and I'm wondering whether you want to go back to the fact that we are dealing with this opioid crisis and whether you see a connection between that, and this is a national problem, it's an urban, suburban, rural problem, and toxic stress.
So an individual who has four or more adverse childhood experiences is 10 times as likely to be an IV drug user as someone with zero adverse childhood experiences.
Wow.
And when we think about the opioid crisis, this isn't just behavioral. What the research is showing, and this is why I'm so excited about this science, what the research is showing is that the part of the brain that is our pleasure and reward center, it's called the ventral tegmental area. And this is a place where, dopamine is the major chemical that functions here. And childhood adversity actually changes the structure and function of the pleasure center of our brains. And it increases the likelihood of developing addictions.
Hmm.
And that is a big part of the reason for this connection. So as we are grappling with this opioid crisis nationally, if we are not addressing childhood adversity as a root cause, right? So, prescription painkillers may have become more available, but if we don't address the source of the driver of substance dependence, we are missing a huge opportunity to help and heal people.
One of the things you write about, the pleasure centers, is essentially for people that have lived with and dealing with toxic stress, is the pleasure center can't get enough pleasure.
Yes,
so
that's
from the
right.
drug, they don't feel the kind of high or pleasure that comes with the addiction, so they want more.
That's right. It's a little bit counterintuitive. You would think that, drug addicts are people who just, love the effect of drugs. And it turns out they actually get less pleasure from activities that should be pleasurable. And the pleasure center of the brain is activated by, heroin, cocaine, opioids, all of these things, but also by high sugar, high fat foods, sex, you know, other things that we think, you know, gambling, right? So when we think about addictions, addressing the impact of childhood adversity is really critical for dealing with the burden of addiction across our society.
I do want to pick up on that. Let me get some callers in. We have Zach from Hocassin, Delaware. Zach, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks.
Definitely have uncovered a bunch of different traumas for me in my childhood. First one being my father was a Vietnam veteran, and he and my mom met, and he left when my mom was 6 months pregnant. So my mom had a fight or flight response, and having me emotionally, mm-hmm. chemically, and it, you know, obviously I'm 42 years old, and it has a lasting effect to this day, just dealing with, my inner masculine, you know, what I'm supposed to do with my mental health as a man. Then at 3.5 years old, being hospitalized with what they thought was kidney failure and all these different things, I was taken away in an ambulance by myself. At that point, those were my first memories.
Sure, sure.
So, and then, you know, just a series of events, you know, losing my grandfather at 16 years old was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back there with that kind of stuff. But basically being 42 years old and having all these things sort of cause landslide effects where that exactly that response that you talk about kind of leaves a wake in my life that I then have to clean the mess up, you know, time and time again. And usually it transpires in my romantic relationships. So it can be tough to kind of see all this stuff coming and develop kind of like you were just talking about, appropriate soothing techniques to meet that pleasure center. You know, one of the things that I do is I kind of go to the extreme. I'm an Ironman athlete, a marathoner, and I've used those things to the nth degree before, and I've figured out that's not so great.
You know, Zach, I really appreciate you calling in because I think you articulate in so many ways not only your life, but I think something that I'm sure Dr. Burke Harris can respond to in terms of here's an adult who had to deal with some adversity as a kid growing up, and he feels like he's not in control of himself.
One of the things that I'm really happy to hear that he's doing is, even though it sounds like it was a little overboard, substituting healthy ways of activating the pleasure center. For example, exercise releases endorphins, right? And that is it's a lot better way to deal with activating that pleasure center as opposed to using opioids, for example. But also, so just recognizing that, oh my goodness, okay, this is me, this is when I have this overactive stress response, is I think one of the most important first steps towards healing. And one of the things that I talk about in the book is that there are a number of things that we can do. Meditation helps to activate the what we call the parasympathetic nervous system, which works in direct opposition to the fight or flight system. So helping to calm our bodies down, and it actually is associated with reducing stress hormones. So that's regular meditation practice. It's one of the things that I recommend. Diet, there's a lot that we can do with diet to support reducing inflammation, enhancing neuroplasticity. And in addition, you know, good old-fashioned mental health care, like it sounds. And there are really six things that I outline in the book, but that's just to give you as a start. I think, like, don't forget just, you know, making that appointment with a mental health professional. But the last thing I would add is also talk to your doctor. Because, you know, go to your doctor and say, hey, listen, I don't know if you've heard of the Adverse Childhood Experiences study. If you haven't heard of it, would you be willing to learn with me about how I can improve my health and improve my life?
Zach, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. I see them coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, Nadine Burke-Harris is our guest. She's a physician. She's an author now, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Let me jump from Zach's call to a young child, and you have many young children in your practice. You talk about the plasticity of the brain, that first 0 to 5 years, or maybe even in your utero to 5 years. How do you intervene knowing a child might be living in an adverse environment?
So the first and most important thing, as I mentioned before, is screening, not waiting until kids have such a dysregulated stress response that they're symptomatic and we're able to see it in front of us. But doing this early identification, because all of the research, all of the science shows us that if we can do early intervention, it gives us more tools, it gives us more opportunity. Little kids have the highest degree of brain plasticity. And when we think about the development of a child's brain and body, we often associate early childhood with brain development. Right. But remember, the immune system is also developing, right? And our hormonal systems are also developing. And so doing that early intervention, the early detection, right, which requires routine screening, is just a critical part of addressing this in young kids.
But I'm sure some situations you might feel as a physician, this child needs to be removed. I mean, in order to protect this child from these toxic stresses, but that is always such a difficult thing for a child.
So that's a great question. And as a physician, I don't make the determination. I may feel, you know, I may observe a scary situation. But I'll tell you, I have met parents who have kids with really high ACE scores, but I've never met a parent who didn't love their child. Mm. And one of the things that we do, and one of the things that screening every child as part of their regular physical exam enables, is for me to say in every visit, listen, these things affect your child's health and well-being, right? It affects their ability to learn, their brain development, the way their bodies develop. And if there is a situation where it is severe and we need to intervene, oftentimes what I'll say to the parent is, because of what your child is experiencing, mm-hmm. Their body's making more stress hormones, and I think it's affecting their health. And so I want to bring resources to help you be able to reduce the dose of adversity your child is experiencing.
So someone to the house to help with parenting or dealing with whatever stresses might be there?
That's right. And we have a multidisciplinary program at the Center for Youth Wellness where we work with case managers or care coordinators, and we have what we call integrated primary care and behavioral health, which is one of the most important interventions also. It's just having that setting where families have access to high-quality care, right there in their doctor's office.
I mentioned this before going on the air, thinking about children growing up in refugee camps, which we know around the world, or in places like Syria and other parts of the world that are being torn apart by civil war. And, you look at what their lives are like, and you look at the danger, the literal war zone that they're living in. Some kids are going to do okay. And what do we need to know about them?
What the research shows us is that when we look at the global data, for kids growing up, even in these intense situations or refugee situations, if they have a safe, stable, and nurturing relationship or a caregiver who's able to be that buffer to stress, because as humans, we biologically have the capacity to buffer each other's stress response. Mm. And if a child has that healthy buffer, an adult who's able to self-regulate and manage that stressful situation for themselves and their child, those kids actually do better.
And even things like touching, I mean, body
exactly.
touching.
So touching is great. So healthy touch is it releases oxytocin. And oxytocin is that bonding hormone that is released during childbirth. And one of the fascinating things, research has shown that oxytocin actually interrupts the fight or flight response. It biologically blocks the fight or flight response. And that is why, you know, having a loving and nurturing partner or caregiver, it's not just that it feels good, it actually is good for you.
We have a lot of people that want to call or talk to you, and I do want to take a break, which we will in just about a minute or so. But let me quote something that the director of the master's program at Thomas Jefferson University, Jean Felter, wrote recently in the Philadelphia Inquirer. She said, "The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates the cost of child maltreatment in the United States to be $124 billion annually, including incarceration, child welfare, unemployment, dropout rates, as well as medical costs associated with chronic diseases such as diabetes, cardiac disease, and some cancers," really underscoring exactly what you are saying, which is this is costing us as a country.
Yes, and I think that $124 billion is an underestimate, frankly, because that is just the cost of child maltreatment. But when we look across the 10 traditional categories of adverse childhood experiences, abuse and neglect constitute 5 out of those 10. But, you know, growing up with a parent who's suffering from severe depression or substance dependence is not even counted in that.
Interesting. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our guest, Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. Her book is The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. And we are talking about the ACE test, how that changed her practice, and the test asking questions about family abuse, neglect, violence, mental illness, divorce, separation, and criminal behavior. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation and get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A tweet from Carrie: "This is the most important work. Thank you." We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me get Kathy from Jenkintown to join our conversation. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I had the honor of raising 3 children from backgrounds of abuse and neglect from other countries. I adopted them 14 years ago.
Wow.
And I think that everything that your guest is saying is spot on. But I do want to talk about and share that underlying impulsive behaviors and self-destructive behaviors, the toughest thing that I saw to get help and treatment for is that there's this undercurrent of self-loathing in the child's own attitude that doesn't show, and self-destructive behaviors. Also, lying as a response to having been traumatized and not trusting anyone in the world.
Those are
whether you refer to that as reactive attachment disorder or whatever you do, it's very difficult to penetrate with any patient that doesn't trust anybody and loathes themselves. Could I ask for some comment on that?
Absolutely.
From your guest?
Kathy, thank you for calling in.
Yes, thank you so much, Kathy. I think as one of the things I was mentioning for my patients is that understanding that some of the things that your kids might be feeling may be as a result of an overactive stress response because of what they've experienced, I think that for many young people, it helps them to realize that, oh my goodness, you mean this is not my fault. I'm not just an awful kid. I feel like a lot of kids experience these feelings in their body, right? You can imagine when you think about the fight or flight response, that if someone is really in your face and you have all these chemical signals saying you either need to fight them or you need to run from them. And when those same chemicals are being released in very high amounts, but you know what? It's not a bear in the woods.
Right.
It's a parent trying to help you get your shoes on, right? but because of what you've experienced, you release those same chemical signals, your brain has a similar response. And I think in order to be able to solve this, I think one of the really important pieces, and when I say solve this, I mean really do real healing, deep healing. We have to divide and tackle and bring as many resources to the table as possible. So yes, we really need high quality mental health care, mm-hmm. but we also need on the medical side for pediatricians and doctors and even adult medicine doctors to be recognizing how do we also heal an overactive stress response.
And to Kathy, I mean, it's terrific that you adopted these three children. It obviously wasn't difficult, and I'm sure it's a long-term situation, but it sounds like if you're there for them, as you mentioned earlier, if there are loving people in people's lives, that can go a long way to making them feel better about themselves.
I'll just say, Kathy, my husband and I have four boys, and our older two are adopted. And I understand some of the challenges of being an adoptive parent. And I just want to tell you, hang in there. The love everything that you put forward is not in vain.
Let me ask you about something else that you write about in this book. And I know that your patient population, largely low income, but you do describe being with friends and at parties and fundraisers. And these are well-heeled people that also have lives and also have dealt with some of these same things that we've been talking about.
So this is actually fascinating because I literally was in the process of writing this book. And I was, everything that's played out is exactly how it happened, which I was at this, very fancy dinner party of among these women who are, trailblazers and running companies and high-powered women. And I said, you guys, I'm writing this book and I'm trying to figure out how to get this across, that this doesn't just happen in low-income populations. What do you think my approach should be? How can I communicate this to audiences? And literally around this dinner table, one of the women who runs a major Silicon Valley company, she put down her spoon and she said, oh my God, this is so important. And she shared her story of how her own child was experiencing symptoms of toxic stress.
Wow.
And it was... And she was very, very generous. I'm grateful to her for allowing me to include that story in the book.
To sort of show how serious it was and how, in a sense, how pervasive it was. And it was right there, but she didn't see it.
And, I had known this woman for some time, and I had no idea that not only did she have some of her own ACEs, but that she had been in a relationship where she was experiencing emotional abuse, and her child was witnessing this verbal violence that was going on in their home, and it was profoundly affecting his health and development. And what she sent back to me, she sent me an email, and she said, this ACEs and toxic stress thrive on secrecy and shame, and that is why it was so important to me to share my story.
And secrecy and shame is that people don't talk about it.
That's exactly right.
Let me get Kelly from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Kelly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for your work, Doctor. I'm also an adoptive parent, and I could ask you a gazillion questions, but I'll leave
do
it
one.
To Yeah. So, okay. The big one I have... Our experience now, our children are grown, but our experience was that no matter where we went, people wanted to diagnose our kids with ADHD, bipolar. So what is the system, doing to sort of say, wait a minute, stop giving all these big diagnoses and take a look way down at the ACEs that you absolutely must know are there when you've adopted, let's say, through foster care or, in our case, it was an international adoption. And I think the parents need so much coaching, like when you adopt early and you're trying and you feel so, like you're sort of messing up all over the place because your child's struggling so much. It's just to have the coaching that, this is all actually quote-unquote normal.
Hmm. It's good you raised two good questions, one about just diagnosis or overdiagnosis, and just what parent, I mean, even beyond adoptive parents, I think all parents need some coaching and support.
Yes. Well, the first question about the ADHD diagnosis is a place where I think that we have a lot of work to do, because that was the big issue for me. That's what got this on my radar. I was being sent so many kids who, saying this child has ADHD, can you put them on Ritalin? And one of the things that I want to emphasize is that when you think about attention deficit, the treatment is to give a stimulant to help to activate the attention if you have an underactive attentive function. But if you have an overactive stress response, then a stimulant may not actually be helpful. And in our study, we did a research study looking at 700 of our patients. And for our patients who had four or more adverse childhood experiences, they were 32.6 times as likely to have learning and behavior problems in school as our patients with zero ACEs. And for our kids with zero ACEs, only 3% of them had learning and behavior problems. But for our kids with four or more ACEs, more than half of them, 51.2%. And in our center, we approach treatment differently, because if we're dealing with learning and behavior problems that are a result of an overactive stress response, the fundamental root cause is this adversity, and you have to work on reducing the dose of adversity before you have any hope of getting this child to be able to function or attend.
So it's helping the family, it's lowering the stresses within the family so the child doesn't feel so reactive?
It can be lowering the stress in the family if that is unaddressed. It can also be helping the child regulate their stress response. In our center, we have, in addition to mental health, we have biofeedback and neurofeedback at the Center for Youth Wellness, which just helps the child learn how to calm their bodies down and actually, again, engage that resting and digesting and turn down the fight or flight nervous system.
And that works? She says quizzically.
We do. Yeah. No, we see really improved outcomes for our kids. Yes.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from Lao. This very issue happened with my child for 5 years during a high conflict divorce. Father insisted on overnights when my child was still breastfeeding and my child would come home waking up multiple times at night. Doctors and family courts do not recognize these issues and children still always demand 50-50 custody. How can this be reversed? I mean, it's interesting. You're a physician, but obviously behaviors and difficult divorces spill over into the legal system, the mental health system, and clearly the doctor's office.
I just had a case like this, actually, with a family that had a very acrimonious separation. And it's true that our courts absolutely don't recognize childhood adversity as a threat to children's health. And in that situation, I was actually asked to write a letter to the court, and one of the things that I mentioned was both parents need to be willing to do everything within their power to support this child's health and well-being and reduce the dose of adversity that their child's experiencing. And I wrote about the science of toxic stress and sent the note to the judge saying, you know, please, as much as in your power, you know, support both parents to be able to recognize this as an issue and get help and implement.
Another email from Laurie. I'm an early intervention provider in the city of Philadelphia. I'd love some suggestions on how to talk to families about these experiences, how they're impacting their family's development, a child's development, without making families feel that they are to blame.
Sure. So one resource that I want to offer is that there is a new website that our center has just launched called Stress Health, stress-health.org. And it's a resource for families to understand more about toxic stress and what they can do for themselves and for their children. In terms of helping families feel like they're not to not feel blamed, I think that's a really important piece. As I mentioned, I've never met a parent who doesn't love their child and want what's best for their child. And so coming from this framework of we recognize that, you know, some of the challenges, whether it's challenges at home or challenges that your child are experiencing, might be affecting their health. And we want to help you provide, we want to help provide you resources to help your child thrive, mm-hmm. right? And that means part of the definition of toxic stress is this overactive stress response in absence of the adequate buffering from a caregiver. And so emphasizing that, you know, we can't do this work if we don't have strong, healthy caregivers. So we want to support you. We want to help you be able to, you know, be more effective in supporting your child, which I think most parents can get behind.
Let me get Marjorie from Philadelphia to join us. Marjorie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I adopted several kids. One when she was seven. Another, Hefiet Mesev American, a street child, when she was six. And then a little kid who was four, who came on the Vietnamese boat lift. The first child was just unbelievable. I mean, she just got along so well, but remembers nothing. Nothing. And she's quite amazing. The second child was fabulous. Graduated from Penn, amazing kid, but never, ever, ever got over being a street child. Never. And we worked on it, and she always knew she was right, which I knew that it was partly protective, but always knew she was right, but sometimes made her very irresponsible. And the third kid is now a physician and amazing, but my question is, how much of that, when you said that some of these kids, especially in refugee camps, emerge even stronger and better and do, but how much of their past should we insist that they investigate, that they know that they...
Sure.
It was because the child who always knew that she was right has died because she absolutely knew she was right and was irresponsible.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Marjorie, I hate to jump in here only because we're almost out of time here, but I do want to give our guests a chance to respond. Three kids, three different experiences. I'm so sorry to hear about the child that died.
Yes. We recognize that the way, so adversity is not destiny, right? And the impact of adversity on health and lifelong outcomes is a combination between nature and nurture, right? Between our genes and our environment. But one of the things that we do know is that when you take, you know, 100 kids who all have the same history, they're far more likely to have difficult outcomes, whether it's health outcomes, behavioral outcomes, whatever they are. And I think it is important just to be for anyone, right? Because this doesn't only happen in certain communities. It's important for all of us to be able to understand, to do a little pulse check and say, you know, do I have a healthy stress response? Because I will say, as a physician, even among my colleagues, I think there are many of us for whom maybe a slightly overactive stress response is actually an asset, right? Mm. That's one of the things
the
I talk about
part, right?
A little later in the book, yeah.
I hate to end on that note, but we're going to do that. Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. The book is called The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. Also, go to our Facebook page, and we posted a TED Talk that our guest, Dr. Burke-Harris, gave just a couple of years ago. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.